Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to Film Sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplex and the art house. What's new on video and streaming, and you might also hear about some dead people we like.
We don't have time for dead people we don't like.
Anyway, this is Film Sociology, where you'll find out what's the next cinematic marvel.
It was unbelievable!
And what's just a movie.
Shut up! My God, you have no freaking life!
Okay, here's your host and my dad, Matthew Soucy.
Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Soucy. The show is available, obviously, as a podcast. It's also available on iTunes, and all of the podcasts here at WFYI are available on Spotify. Well, friends, we made it through another week. I hope you're staying safe, hope you're staying healthy, hope you're staying sane, and hope you're seeing movies. And apparently you can go to the drive-ins now and check them out. So we'll get to that in a little bit. But I do want to play an interview I did earlier today, as well as dip into the archives based on the first interaction I had on this week's show. I'm going to talk with playwright, actor, director, Renaissance man Ben Ayers, who is one of the founders of the Timepiece Theater Company, and he's going to talk a little bit about his theater company and not just this theater company, but all arts organizations have had to adjust in the last couple of months. Enjoy. So, Ben, what is the background on Timepiece Theater?
So, I began this at the end of 2018 with my good friend Jim Tillett, who's also a great director, and we wanted to use theater to teach people about science and history. And then pretty soon after we got together and started working on this, we met Mark Kiesling, who runs an organization called the Da Vinci Pursuit. And their whole mission is mixing art with science. And so those things matched up pretty well. And we partnered with them pretty soon after. So thanks to, us getting together with Mark and Da Vinci, we've been able to do some pretty cool programming over the last year and a half or so.
In a way, this is another aspect of non-traditional theater, right? Because it's not just a stage. You can go to a classroom, a library, what have you, right?
Yeah, and in some cases, even outdoor co-ops and nature hikes or offices or, breweries and restaurants and stuff like that. And so in many cases, it's sort of just, being flexible enough to fit into any box. And sometimes the performances can be long form, and other times it might just be a few minutes. But if we can inspire people and even teach people something just for a minute or two, that's a performance, and that's a win in our book.
Now, according to Timepiece Theater, I know you have four individuals, you have four characters that are available to go and to educate and entertain. Who is this quartet?
Right. So our featured ones, and we just added a couple as well.
Okay.
Thomas Say, who was a zoologist in the middle part of the 1800s. He's portrayed by a good friend of yours, Matt Walls, Prince Hal, as you know him.
Yep.
We have an Irish canal worker who represents the laborers who worked on the canals through Indiana. Nathan Thomas, great actor in town, portrays him. Elisa Roan plays the amazing Gene Stratton Porter, who was, of course, an author and a naturalist. And then a couple of new ones. Shantae Gaston, a great actor in town, is portraying Susie King Taylor, who was a nurse during the Civil War. And then David Mosdale is portraying Robert Owen, who was an industrialist, but who also tried to create a utopia in New Harmony, Indiana. So they all have their own history. And they all have their own, contribution that they gave to science, which we think is important for people to know about.
I should do a little full disclosure since you already brought into it. I know a few of these folks, shared the stage with a few of these folks, and in fact, Ben was in the first play I ever wrote that was produced here in Indianapolis about 1,000 years ago. So there, full disclosure.
Very good memories. Very good memories.
Thank you. So when did as far as you writing this, how much, how much research did you do, and when did the research begin?
Some of these people I was fortunate enough to learn a little bit about through working at museums in town. And then, you know, based on what I thought would you know, the things that would come together, is it a good story? You know, what was this person up against? You know, what did they want, and what were the kind of obstacles they had to face? And then also, you know, is their story relevant apart from history? Meaning, you know, there are a lot of interesting things that have happened, but can we directly match it to something current? And so, for example, when you look at, you know, somebody like Thomas Say, who's, you know, a famous entomologist, and you think about kind of the state of danger that insects and pollinators are in and how relevant that is. Well, that's a good story. It's something we can apply to what's going on today. Or, for example, you know, Susie King Taylor, one of our new characters, who was a nurse during the Civil War. You know, that was a different time, obviously, in medical history. And only through scientists and thinkers and innovators did we kind of get out of that state of limitation for medicine. And you can certainly apply medicine to what's going on with everybody right now in the world. So that's kind of the idea.
Mm-hmm. And I, going back a little bit, you've also done theater similar to this. I know you've done the You Are There series that the History Museum has done in the past.
Yeah, definitely. And so, you know, that's kind of where you begin to learn a little bit more about how flexible theater can be. And how there are so many different ways where you can reach people. And so with all of the characters, we can certainly do script, long-form scripted performances, which match what you would think of as traditional theater. And then we can also do the more free-form things. You see it at different institutions here and museums here in town, where it's a little bit more conversational and kind of depends on where the audience members or just one audience member wants to go and what it is that they want to know about.
So are you saying that there's for lack of a better comparison, there's a 60-minute version, a 30-minute version, a 15-minute version?
Yeah, exactly. And even if, you know, even if it's just more freeform. So the idea that if we're at a convention or a festival or a park or a nature hike and people are just kind of, you know, the crowd is coming and going, then the characters that we have out there and the skilled actors who are doing it can kind of, you know, they're familiar enough with the material that they can just speak on the content and on, you know, on the character freely, even if it just is a few minutes at a time with different people coming and going.
That's got to be a fun challenge because, as you mentioned, to have a grip of the text and then to be able to adjust according to the environment that you're performing in.
Exactly. And it also it opens our thing up to more people. You know, I love it, and I know that you love the traditional theater experience, mm-hmm. but that's not going to capture everybody. Not everybody is willing to sit down for 60 minutes. And so, you know, what you can do is you can catch them for a couple of minutes. And if there's somebody who has not been exposed to theater or hasn't had any interest in it before, this could really crack the door. And then maybe they want to see more and more of that.
And is there generally a kind of a Q&A banter at one point?
Yeah, usually. I mean, I think it doesn't take much for people to kind of to get into it. I mean, sometimes it can be very intimidating. But once they latch onto something interesting, and we think that these characters have things that are interesting, and again, like I said, relevant to everybody, then it doesn't take long before they've really bought into it. And And that goes to a lot of things. I mean, you know, obviously the look of the character will draw people in, and maybe they might have something to show, like Thomas Say might have an insect to show them. And then before you know it, they've been drawn in, which stands again to the people in history we've chosen, but also the skill of the people that we've been working with.
Now, I know when you guys organized this, when it first started, I know I'm curious if you had pandemic situations in mind when you were prepping this company.
No, we didn't. But you know.
But now everybody has.
I mean, when I was researching and putting together the program about Susie King Taylor, you know, the character talks all about kind of being embedded with these Civil War troops and these Union soldiers. And while they were on this island preparing for combat, there was an outbreak of smallpox, and, you know, how she was able to deal with that. And I thought, well, yeah, people might be able to relate to this, the idea of widespread disease and panic, not knowing that that's exactly what we're dealing with right now. But yeah, the idea that, you know, live theater can't completely be replaced by stuff that we're doing on Zoom and video. I mean, if it were, I think theater people would have been out of the business years ago. But you can still, if you can be flexible, you can still try to reach people, you know, to the best of your ability. And that's what we're trying to do, just kind of continue to be flexible and reach people how we can.
How is the situation happening with your company now compared to, say, March?
Well, yeah, that's the thing. We've had to in many cases cancel performances and programs that we had scheduled. You know, we haven't been able to get together as, you know, a playwright and a director and a performer and a facilitator and things like that. So we've been trying to do this the best we can from our own kind of isolated spots, you know. But again, it's if nothing else, if we can kind of continue to show what we do and maybe give little teasers, then that can engage people enough until we can eventually get back out there.
Yeah.
And do what it is that we do. You know, we're not a film production company. We do live theater. But we can do the best we can at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know March was, I was supposed to be in a show in April and that got canned, and I'm supposed to be directing a show in October, and we're still kind of going forward with it. But I think every arts organization right now, there's an asterisk. There's a TBA or TBD. It's not just a question of moving forward, but to see, well, we can move forward. We just hope that the world is able to adjust and we're able to be able to continue.
Exactly. Yeah. And that, you know, and I think that kind of general fear of, will they be ready for us when this is all over? But I think the answer to that is definitely, I think in many cases, they might crave it even more. But the fact that, and, you know, again, Mark Kiesling from the Da Vinci Pursuit, our partner organization, he uses the great term nimble all the time. If you can be more nimble and have as little overhead as possible, which we do, because most of the funds we need go directly to the artists that we're working with or the scientists or the facilitators we're working with, then you have a better chance of, again, fitting yourself into any box, whether that means, you know, really short performances at a safe social distance, maybe even outdoors, or, you know, performances kind of through the safety of a glass window, which is an idea that one of our featured actors, Matt Walls, has been talking about. Or again, you know, video and live stream. So it's just trying to allow yourself to come up with creative ideas to use performance to help teach people.
Yep. And I think in the case of something like Timepiece, because it's one artist, an organization or a location, it might be a good way to put your toe in the water to see how something like that would go over.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, see what people are ready for and also what length of performance people are ready for.
Mm-hmm.
And then go from there, because, it, you know, it's asking a lot. And as you know, and every person who's involved with live theater knows, it's difficult sometimes to gather a crowd under perfect conditions.
Yes.
And, you know, when people aren't anxious and scared and, you know, suffering financially. So, mm-hmm. You know, the simpler, I think, at the moment, the simpler and the more nimble you can be, the better.
Yes. So, Ben, where can folks get in touch with Timepiece Theater Company?
Yeah. So timepiecetheater.com, or you can find us on Facebook. And then, again, our partner organization, the Da Vinci Pursuit, davincipursuit.com. They also have a great presence on Facebook, and you can look there and see about the stuff that we've been doing and also, you know, stuff that we've been able to post as far as video and stuff like that.
All right, shifting gears a little bit because, you know, stage sociology happens sometimes during film sociology, but you've been stuck inside. What have you been watching recently?
Okay, so quite a bit, but I've boiled it down to a few that I thought you specifically would appreciate.
Oh, here we go. All right.
Okay?
All right.
So the first one on the list, Cat People from 1982.
Oh, Paul Schrader. Yes. Yep.
Malcolm McDowell and
Sasha Kinski. John Hurd, Annette O'Toole, music by David Bowie. Oh gosh, what made you pick that?
Staring at the TV screen and seeing that it was available. I said, I haven't seen this.
Oh, you hadn't?
I had not seen it before, no. First time.
Yes, I saw it when it came out on video, and there, I believe in the early incarnations of HBO, that was a staple. And guys of a certain age, like Klaus's daughter, and one of his more glossier pictures of Mr. Schrader, kind of like American Gigolo.
Mm-hmm.
Did you enjoy it?
Yeah, they were definitely cat people. I mean, you can't argue that.
And not a musical.
Right. Yeah, slightly different.
Yeah. All right. Okay, good. Go on.
Okay. One that I really enjoy, The Duelists, 1978.
I just watched that probably over a month ago because I got it on Blu-ray. It's, of course, Harvey Keitel, Keith Carradine, yeah. Albert.
And early Ridley Scott.
I think his first film, this is the film he did before Alien.
Yeah. So really visually cool. Something that I've seen a bunch and I can't seem to get tired of it.
When you think you hold a grudge, you can watch that and go, okay, I'm not so bad.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. Yeah, I'm not that angry at this person.
There's Albert Finney has one scene in it, and I listened to the Ridley's commentary track, and apparently he did it partly as a favor, and I believe he got a case of champagne for payment.
Not bad.
That's not bad at all.
Not bad. All right, moving forward. You ready?
Yes, I'm ready.
Here's another one that I hadn't seen. I know it was one of my favorites of my dad, who talked about it quite a bit, but I had never seen it. But there it was, Runaway Train. 1985.
Oh, I also have found that on a DVD earlier this year. Yeah. Of course, John Voight and Eric Roberts both got nominations. Rebecca De Mornay's in it. It's based on a Kurosawa script. And I think
Danny Trejo.
Yes.
Was the boxing teacher for Eric Roberts. And then if he, of course, is one of the other prisoners in that boxing match early on.
Correct.
If I'm not wrong, I think that's what it was.
No, you are absolutely correct. I believe that's how Trejo got into the business.
Yeah. And we're all better for it.
We are all better for it. And the fact that that dude is, I believe, in his 70s, which meant he was starring in Machete in his 60s. So
yeah, tough as nails.
And Hollywood likes old guys that kick butt. I'm sorry, folks.
Yeah.
The other side note with Runaway Train, and it's a damn good thriller, but that is one of the rare prestige films from Canon Films. There's a documentary, if you haven't seen it, called Electric Boogaloo: The History of Canon Films, and they did some films they're known for the Charles Bronson and the Chuck Norris movies and some other schlocky stuff. But by the 80s, they also negotiated deals where, like, if you want the Charles Bronson movie, you have to take this John Cassavetes movie. Or if you want this Chuck Norris movie, you got to take something like Runaway Train. So there were actually some legit films, some of them odder than others. But Runaway Train is probably near the top of the canon fodder.
Mm-hmm.
You enjoyed that one as well?
I did, yes.
Cool.
Yes. That train was running away.
All right, what else is on the list?
Okay, so the final one on my list here.
Okay.
And this kind of ties it up because this is another one that involves John Hurd. Mm. This was a big one from when I was a young teenager. And I find it interesting. I watched it again recently, and it's interesting because it's been covered over completely in many ways because of its name. And I'm not talking about the Gladiator that everybody's thinking about, but the 1992 movie Gladiator another one about boxing with Ossie Davis, Cuba Gooding Jr.
Yep.
And the late, great Brian Dennehy.
Nice. Nice. I think I saw that once on cable, and that's been it. How does it hold up?
You know, it's okay. And it has that kind of dark, overcast South Chicago look to it, and kind of, you know, unlicensed boxing, smoky club look to it, and some great performances and some great people that signed on to do it.
I believe that was Gooding's first film, or one of his first films after Boys in the Hood.
Yeah, I think you're right. And again, I mean, he was great. He was great in it. I mean, he was my hero when I saw it. So
okay.
No, as a young kid, that was a big one. And then, of course, you know, it's called Gladiator. And there was a slightly more successful movie, I think, called Gladiator that came later.
It happens.
And that was that.
Now, was this actually shot in Chicago, or did did another city pose as Chicago?
It has to have been.
Man, I hope so.
I could be wrong, but I'm almost positive it was. Again, you know, the main character, what's his name? James Marshall plays him, I think.
Yeah.
But his dad is John Hurd.
Oh.
And, which ties it right back to cat people. Which, you know, eventually you're going to go back to cat people.
I had when John Hurd died, I had Lou Harry on the show to talk about his legacy, because I believe Lou saw him do some theater live. And he was that kind of – there was that wave of New York stage actors in the late 70s and early 80s that got into film, guys like William Hurt and him. Because he did a couple of cult films in the late 70s. One was called Cutter's Way with Jeff Bridges. There was one called Shady Chilly Scenes of Winter, which is really hard to find. And Cat People was an early one. I gravitated toward it with the film version of The Trip to Bountiful, which I was fortunate enough to direct twice. And he played the son in that. And then it was fun to introduce the way Emma, my daughter's 18, the way she discovered John Hurd was I had shown her the film Trip to Bountiful. Then we saw the first Sharknado, which he was in. I know. And then, of course, he was the bad guy in Big and the nemesis in Awakenings.
Yeah.
So everybody has a path.
The first time I really recognized him, I mean, for my generation, he was the dad in Home Alone.
That's right, yes.
The first time I knew of him at all. And so then to learn, oh, yeah, look at all this cool, weird stuff he's done. Cool.
Everybody has a different path with somebody's IMDb page. I guess that's the beauty of film.
Yeah.
So. Well, Ben, once again, pitch the theater website, social media, and you know, hopefully we can get moving as far as live theater, and in this case, live educational theater.
Yeah, definitely. So thanks again, Matt. Timepiecetheater.com, and you can see us on Facebook as well. And then our partner organization, the Da Vinci Pursuit, DaVinciPursuit.com, and check them out on Facebook as well. And we'll try to do what we can. And again, getting out of this will be on the backs of scientists and thinkers and innovators, and that's who we're trying to highlight. So there you go.
My chat with Ben Ayers of Timepiece Theater Company, and he mentioned all the social media stuff. As I mentioned, Ben was the lead in my very first play that I had produced here in Indianapolis. It was also the first play I ever wrote called Love and Turtle Wax. So always good to talk to Ben. Thank you, friend. And now, I didn't know what movies he was going to be talking about. I knew we would be discussing, obviously, Timepiece Theater Company. But the fact that he brought up John Hurd, and we went down a little bit of a dive with the films of John Hurd, a great excuse for me to dip into the archives to 2017 and a chat I had with Lou Harry, fellow critic and man of all trades, man of all skills, just a really good guy. But I had him on this show the week John Hurd died to talk a little bit more about his film and stage work and his legacy. So here's Lou Harry and I discussing John Hurd. Joining me on Film Sociology is a longtime IFJA member and IBJ guru, entertainment editor. But Lou Harry is hanging out with me. How are you, Lou?
I'm doing good. That's a lot of initials throwing out.
PDQ, and that that bit Robin Williams does in Good Morning Vietnam. Anyway, we're here to talk a little bit about the career of actor John Hurd, who passed away last week. And of course, all of the news headlines. And it's a little frustrating, but basically every headline had him referred to as Home Alone actor,
including Variety,
including Variety, because, ladies and gentlemen, that is the film that John Hurt appeared in that apparently made the most money.
Right.
But this is a man whose career spans over 40 years.
Hundred and some
credits and TV. And just, you know, and in the going back to the 70s and early 80s, classic that guy whose name you wound up memorizing pretty early on.
Right. I would say, you know, into the 80s and 90s, it was a lot of that guy. Early on, it was the potential for, I mean, he was doing leading roles.
Right. We were talking before recording, there was a wave of New York actors making the transition from stage to screen in the late 70s, early 80s, and Hurd was a part of that wave.
Right. He was doing a theater in New York, was in, you know, Shakespeare in the Park stuff, was Cassio and Othello, was understudying Hamlet, did a Broadway gentleman caller in The Glass Menagerie. So he was, you know, he was getting the parts.
Yes, he was. And kind of looking back at his career, and yes, we will be going through the IMDb list because that's what we do here at times. but yeah, he had a couple of lead roles in films that have now had a cult status following. There's a great three-volume book series by Danny Peary called Cult Movies, two of which were featuring him are mentioned in those series. Mm. And Lou watched one recently, and I watched the other recently. We didn't plan this; it just kind of happened. But it turns out I got a bonus in the guest department because I know I found out from Lou that Chilly Scenes of Winter really resonated with Lou Harry, not just because he's a John Hurd fan. Lou, please.
No, I in part became a John Hurd fan because of Chilly Scenes of Winter and to a lesser extent Between the Lines and then Cutter's Way, which we'll talk about. But Chilly Scenes of Winter is a 1979 film based on a Joan Micklyn Silver directed, one of the early women directors,
right,
too, who did some substantial work, but based on an Ann Beattie novel. Now, if you don't know Ann Beattie, she was very much almost the quintessential New Yorker short story writer.
Mm-hmm.
Her stuff was very, almost felt passive in the writing. Her characters weren't, as a rule, strongly motivated to do anything. And Chilly Scenes of Winter is kind of quintessential of that. It's about a guy who, and we flash all over the place in this, but the core story is Charles was kind of a desk job guy in a bland place, and he's doing okay. He has kind of a hanger-on friend, and his sister's in college,
and
he's inherited the house, and his mother's a mess, but he's getting by.
Right.
And he meets this woman, Laura, who has just left her husband. Not divorced, but has separated from her husband. They meet, there's a romance, goes on a couple of months, she goes back to her husband. Now, this is not told chronologically.
No.
It's told out of sequence. We meet Charles when, long after, maybe a year after, they've broken up and she's gone back to her husband. And as his life has continued to be pretty much nothing that he can be passionate about, he becomes more and more locked onto the idea that that relationship was something truly special. Mm. And he's wrestling with how to and whether to get her back. And it's the book is great. The book is great. The movie's really interesting because he has all of the sort of charm and in quirks and interest of the traditional romantic leading man, but you're not sure whether his mission, you can't fully get behind his mission.
Right. There's a number of romantic comedies, ladies and gentlemen, before we go off too much on a tangent. It's if normal-looking people acted the way the folks in romantic comedies acted, My Best Friend's Wedding, How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days, while you were sleeping, you would need therapy. You would need state-appointed counseling. But because it's the good-looking, handsome, attractive actors that we enjoy, we accept it, I think, a little bit more as an audience. But Also, and Chilly Scenes of Winter was a film I had never seen until last year. Mm-hmm. So anytime I see a film that is listed in the cult movies book by Danny Perry, I get really excited. And this was one of those. And watching it, what I remember, and I think it's fresher in Lou's memory than mine, but yeah, it is. I don't think United Artists tried to push this as a typical romantic comedy because I think they would have lost a lot of money. but they were kind of perplexed at what they had. But watching it finally, I think every independent romantic comedy of the last 15, 20 years owe a huge debt to Chilly Scenes of Winter. And you cited one of the more notable romantic comedies of the last decade that really is a bridge with
which was 500 Days of Summer, mm-hmm. which I think if you truly connected to that movie and got the fact that it's about a guy who is romanticizing a relationship that he's romanticizing a romance.
Right.
He's romanticizing the relationship he had with this woman, and that really it wasn't what he's turned it into in his mind. Mm-hmm. Then you would really connect it to Chilly Scenes of Winter. It has such a the universe that this guy's in is so interesting and grounded.
Yep. And you know. But there's also breaking of the fourth wall.
Yes.
You said the chronological aspect of it, and then of course the behavioral aspects
right.
of it.
And there are moments where you totally buy into, yes, that moment between them was magical. That moment between them was wonderful. And then there's a little scary moment. And then there's, you know, and then he says something totally inappropriate. It's also a really good film and anyone who's been in any kind of relationship for any time knows that sometimes you don't say the right thing, or sometimes you say the right thing at the wrong time.
Right.
And there's wonderful moments like that. And Mary Beth Hurt, no relation, who plays opposite him in this, is terrific. Peter Riegert is wonderful. And Gloria Graham.
I know. Kenneth MacMillan. And I feel terrible. The guy who played Niedermeyer in Animal House. Yes, there's two Animal House alum in this film, ladies and gentlemen.
But it has sort of a strange history, too. It was originally released, they changed the title to The Incredibly Bland Head Over Heels.
Yeah.
And released it with don't want to spoil anything. Spoiler
sure.
alert. Fast forward 3 minutes. But they released it with what sort of is a happy ending. Now, the ending, though, this is going to be confusing.
It's okay.
The ending of Head Over Heels is closer in action to the ending of the book.
Mm-hmm.
But it's off in tone.
Okay.
It feels like it's trying to be a happy ending and trying to excuse everything that's come before. And it shouldn't. So when the film disappeared quickly, they recut it and let Joe McConsilver put the ending and basically cut off the ending, cut off that happy ending moment, left it at the introspective downer point that is in a way in tone truer to the book. So by getting away from the facts of the book, they became truer to the book in the edited version.
Yeah.
That went out again under the title Chilly Scenes of Winter. It also tanked, but
right.
You know.
And this was, and this era always fascinates me because the film came out in 1979. Hollywood is in full blown blockbuster mode because of Star Wars, right. Jaws, all that stuff. So I've always been fascinated by the smaller pictures that the studio either wasn't paying attention to or didn't care. This was one of those. This
right.
was, you know, there's like, well, it's not very expensive. We'll just kind of plop it out there and see what happens.
On the other hand, this was the early days of HBO, and which is where I encountered it, whether
okay.
it was on HBO or Showtime or whatever the
sure.
the pay
but
service
figured,
was.
If they couldn't get it in the theaters, they could slap it on TV and play it 10 times
right.
a week.
So I ended up seeing it like 5 times in 2 weeks or something, which let me feed it in a pre VHS
yes.
obsession. You know, that was the way you sort of got to know a film.
Take note, kids.
Right. And I ended up, you know, I think the book and the film have had a huge influence on my writing.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly rereading parts of the book again and seeing the film again, I could see my attempt to be Ann Beattie in some of my playwriting and some of my book writing. But that wasn't his first... his first sort of starring role. The sort of entry point into Hollywood was Between the Lines, which was
right.
also a Joan Micklin Silver film,
mm-hmm.
which is really interesting. I haven't been able to find it recently. Saw it again a couple of years ago. That is an ensemble comedy drama, more comedy. You know, it's in that vague.
Yes.
But it's about an alternative newspaper, kind of the equivalent of Nouveau News Weekly, in Boston.
Bruno Kirby, I believe, is in
it's
this.
An amazing
yeah,
cast.
Yeah, if you look at it, it's like a That Guy Quirk
it's
fest.
It's Lindsay Krause. It's Jill Eikenberry.
Right.
It's Michael J. Pollard.
All these young, up-and-coming, hungry actors.
Jeff Goldblum.
Yes.
And it goes even deeper mm-hmm. than that. But it's about the staff of this paper. So we go in and out of their lives, their love lives, their ambitions, the guy who wants to be a writer, a novelist, the one who this, the one who that, the romances. And some of the performances are a little awkward now, but really earnest.
Mm-hmm.
But Heard is just grounded and true. And in this, in Chilly Seasons of Winter, and in even the smaller things he's done since then, there's almost always a sense in the guy that there's a joke in his head that he's not sure he should tell or not.
Yes. When he passed, Daniel Stern went on social media and wrote about, he was very dear friends with Heard, and they did a couple of films together, but they, I think, lived together for a while, mm-hmm. and told about some of the some of the antics that went on. And so, it's funny that you mentioned that because, they were, not the hellraisers of the English classical train theater guys, but they were New Yorker guys, 20-something guys in New York in the 70s and 80s, and they were having a good time.
And Heard was very introspective later about how he went from theater to film and didn't fully appreciate and respect the guy behind the camera and the person doing mm-hmm. the sound. And and I think there's sort of a sadness to that, that he did have a number of key starring roles. Those films weren't ones that took off.
Right.
And so he became the guy who took every job. And became known for things like Home Alone,
but also became known that he was going to be good even if the material wasn't, and right. we'll get to that.
Yes, we'll get to that phase.
But you talk about, because you mentioned Between the Lines, and then a few other projects, which right. Those are ones you're still kind of looking for. You might see if somebody put it on YouTube. We don't condone such behavior.
The other early one is Between the Lines, Chilly Scenes. Between them was a prison film called On the Yard. Which I haven't seen in 30 years, but remember being
I remember
very strong.
First Love with William Catt and Susan
yeah,
Day.
Yeah, doing
Rush
the supporting
it.
Thing.
But then there was
Heartbeat, as Jack
Right,
Carroll.
We'll get to that. So, so if we kind of, here were your first, and then these were all released in a row.
Right.
Within 1979 and 1982. Yeah, Chilly Scenes of Winter, didn't do well. Heartbeat, where he's Jack Kerouac, and it was a film with Nick Nolte and Sissy Spacek, and it didn't quite find
right,
an audience.
Look, another one that most people saw because it was an early HBO.
Right. And then Cutter's Way, which I'll get to in a sec. And then Paul Schrader's Cat People, which
right.
different. But yeah, Cutter's Way, you talk about a contrast from Chilly Scenes of Winter to this, and then also playing Jack Kerouac in Heartbeat. But Cutter's Way almost became Cutter and Bone, which I'm surprised they didn't use that because United Artists could have passed this off as an intense Southern California detective thriller,
right.
which it's not.
Right.
But it's Jeff Bridges, a mustachio Jeff Bridges, plays a kind of a small-time gigolo who is accused of a murder, and his best friend, it's funny, the connections between this and Lebowski.
Right. He witnesses
a murder.
Maybe.
But his best friend is a one-eyed, limped veteran hellraiser played by John Heard, who has it in his head that a high-profile businessman is the killer.
Right. And there's another case, in a way connected in a weird way to Chilly Scenes of Winter, because it's about a guy who latches onto an idea.
And won't
and
let
that
go.
Idea becomes the thing he won't let go, but a completely different character.
Yeah, I mean, not there's a scene. His first scene, it's in a bar late at night, and he's quoting Shakespeare, and then he's dropping some racial epithets
right.
in front of the majority of the crowd, and it's not going to end well.
Right. And let's put ourselves back in 1981, after a string of films where we're supposed to, suddenly in films realize that the Vietnam War had happened. And are treating, Vietnam vets in a way that is sort of ultra respectful. And here's a guy who is who went through the war. We don't get a whole lot of the background, but he's deeply damaged. He's a smart guy, and he's taking advantage of it.
Mm-hmm.
There's an there's an amazing scene where he crashes a car in a neighbor's driveway.
Inebriated.
And horrible. He's drunk. Yeah. I mean, he's a danger to everyone. He's being horrible, and he's being a jerk to the guy who's, you know, the neighbor. And then the cops show up, and he
plays the vet card, yeah.
Yeah, and it's amazing. And yeah, right, and he does the, I know a little something about duty, he says to the police officer. You know, and you feel for the neighbor because he can't win.
Right, and the more he gets exasperated, the worse he looks.
Right.
Because of this veteran.
Right.
Yeah, it's another solid thriller, and it's also in the Danny Perry books, and it's funny because watching this with Jeff Bridges, I kept thinking of the relationship between the dude and Walter in Big Lebowski to a much more animated sense of that collaboration.
And a breathtaking performance by Lisa Eichorn.
Yeah.
Who had her shot. I mean, basically, it was that in Yanks and then kind of disappeared.
Right, but still working.
Still working, know, yeah. Still gets the work. Yeah. But man, when you get a part like that, she, I wonder, you can't change history, but
right.
What happens if that film had been, if Cutter's Way had been acknowledged for the film it is, and it's a great, I mean, I believe it's a truly great film.
Mm-hmm.
If that had been acknowledged and he had even gotten an Academy Award nomination. I mean, that was, I think, Raging Bull year, if I'm not mistaken.
This came out in 81, so it's the year of Reds, Chariots Fire, Raiders of the Lost Ark, Atlantic City.
But it's in that ballpark.
Right.
And, you know,
Maybe a little boost.
It would have changed. I mean, for an actor...
Mm-hmm.
He might have, you know, and, you know, Cat People was probably already in Cannes, which I still think is a neat film.
I love Paul Schrader films, no matter how good or how bad they can be.
Right.
And the fact that he was in trying to do a sort of remake of a Cat People story from the 40s, and there's a weird incestuous thing between Sasha Kinski and Malcolm McDowell and Annette O'Toole. I mean, it's fascinating. It is truly an early 80s film of every sense of the word from the synth score. And
yeah, but it also does a neat thing in the beginning. It does the we're going to do a very violent opening so that you know we're capable of that. And then we're going to be suspenseful for a long time.
And you're going to wait for another moment like the beginning.
Right.
You're
going to know we're capable. But, you know, then you start to see the dip after Cutter's Way and Cat People.
Chud.
Then it's Chud, which I went to see in the theaters.
Also on HBO like every other day.
But I went to see that the weekend it opened.
Really?
Because John Hurd and Daniel Stern were in it.
Roommates.
I remember going from college out to see Chud because I was excited that a John Hurd film.
There's a couple other titles which I still haven't found, but there's one that he appeared in that I think is underappreciated, and it sometimes gets lumped into the kind of horny teenager films, but he played Brother Timothy in Heaven Help Us.
And he's great, and I hated that movie.
You hated the movie? Okay, so it's set in a Catholic high school in the 60s. Probably was shot in Toronto, for all we know.
Right.
But because you have Donald Sutherland, Kevin Dillon, who's trying to be Matt Dillon, his brother, not quite, but Andrew McCarthy, Kate Reed, that's how I also know it's Canadian, Mary Stuart Masterson, and Wallace Shawn has a cameo, and it is these guys chasing girls and the usual high school shenanigans. It just happens to be set in a Catholic school in the 60s, so you have men in robes, and they're slapping hands with, you know, the wooden paddles, and I mean, it's
altar boys getting excited when girls are going up for communion.
And, yeah, Patrick Dempsey's in it. So yeah, there's all those horny aspects, but it does have a heart with Andrew McCarthy and Mary Stuart Masterson. And Hurd plays the cool brother, the one who has baseball cards, the one who smokes, the one who hangs out at the, you know, at the soda shop.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you hate this film?
Oh, I remember, and that was another one. I think I was reviewing it in college and just thought this. And I have a problem with a lot of the teen films. I mean, I'm one of the people who can't stand 16 Candles.
I'm with you on that because I was a kid. The films of the S.E. Hinton novels ruined the John Hughes suburban fairy tales for me.
Anyway. I'll take Some Kind of Wonderful from the John Hughes-ish canon, but that's about it.
I'm still watching Rumblefish.
There you go. I just was really crushed and disappointed and liked but liked Hurd in it. I mean, Hurd was was strong. The next one was another that he's really good in After Hours.
Scorsese, and I remember being 15 years old and declaring that the best film of 1985.
Okay.
It was just weird all night. Right. Griffin Dunne in this kind of New York Inferno after midnight kind of place.
He plays the bartender in that sort of gets circled back to a couple times.
A little bit.
If you have a conversation with somebody about the films of Martin Scorsese, After Hours may be one of the last films you talk about.
Probably.
It just doesn't come up in conversation.
And Scorsese in the 80s is a fascinating time, but that's another discussion here or there. Right. It's a film that's very near and dear to my heart, and I got to direct the play twice, but he got to play Ludie Watts in the film version of Horton Foote's Trip to Bountiful.
After Hours, Heaven Help Us.
Not bad.
That might be
my favorite John Hurd year.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, Trip to Bountiful, Robert Mulligan directed it. But it's a woman, a widow, Mrs. Watts, who's living with her son, who is recovering from a long illness and is trying to get back in the workforce, the domineering daughter-in-law. And all Mrs. Watts wants to do is return to her childhood home in Bountiful one final time. It's played by the great Geraldine Page. She won Best Actress that year. And Ludie is a hard, I mean, they're all difficult roles. Mrs. Watts carries the film and carries the play. I called Gene Adams Queen Lear for carrying that. Jessie May, who's the daughter-in-law, you have to make her antagonistic without making her into a villain. She's also kind of the comic relief. And the Ludie role that John Hurd plays, as we were working on the script, it's a lot of yes, ma'am, no, ma'am, yes, Jessie May, no, Jessie May, but you get a heartbreaking monologue at the end about everything that Ludie felt he should have done as a husband and as a son. And Hurd just brings it. I mean, I think it's a great, great film.
It's probably the closest thing to seeing him on stage. And I would have loved to have seen him on stage, but I'm guessing that performance is probably the... You know, part of it is because the film has stage roots.
So you talked about him taking projects and he appeared in Robert Redford's film version of the Milagro Beanfield War
with a neat confrontation with Christopher Walken.
Yep.
In that.
But
again, that's very much an ensemble
exactly
piece. So it's easy to I'm sure there were many reviews at the time that didn't mention him.
Right.
You know,
but it was that there he is.
Yeah, and he's good and. He put the collar back on for The Seventh Sign.
He's in The Seventh Sign, which is weird. And then my daughter got to see some of his work recently because she fell in love with the film Big. There was then there was another way where he was maybe either second level or the like Big
under the title
where he's the antagonist.
Beaches.
He's the object, and then he's also an antagonist in Awakenings. In 1990. So, and then I know he appeared in Betrayed and The Package.
Package I haven't seen. Does that hold up?
It's an Andrew Davis. It's not my fifth favorite Andrew Davis film, but and then in one year he appeared in Awakenings and then Home Alone, which of course made a gajillion dollars. And
right.
Thanks, Variety.
I'm sure the house and pool were paid for by that.
And good for him. But then following up.
Going back to The Package.
Go ahead. Yes.
For Indianapolis audiences.
Oh.
Butler University head of theater department Diane Timmerman has a small part in that film.
No way.
Did you know that?
I did not.
In The Package. Yes, she does.
Okay, there's a joke, and I'm not going to do it, and Diane's going to hit me.
For that.
So I will look for Diane Timmerman in The Package. Going through Deceived, Radio Flyer. He had his cameo in Rambling Rose.
And you can see in the, we start to get in that phase of the resume where it feels like. Yes, there are some that are clearly just, I need the gig, but good directors are hiring him.
Yeah.
You know, you have Redford hiring him for Milagro Beanfield War. You have In the Line of Fire.
Yeah.
You have, Pelican Brief. You have...
Yeah, the first time I realized it, because Alan Pakula directed Pelican Brief, and his character doesn't last very long, but there's a scene with his shirt off, and you're like, he's getting older. He's got a cut, like me. Look at that.
He's a human being.
And then there was a before and after with Barbet Schroeder, and I remember I actually watched a few episodes. I was a fan of the film version of The Client, and of course they tried to make a TV show of that with Jo Beth Williams in the Susan Sarandon role, and he's the Tommy Lee Jones character, Roy, Reverend Roy. And then, yeah, just constantly working.
Working.
Animal
right.
Factory, Snake Eyes, Silent Cradle. He was the dean in O. That's right. And so now we're at a point. I'm not going to bring up White Chicks. I just did.
But and there's TV movies and
a lot of TV
appearances.
Stuff. So he's one of those actors also that I ask you, Lou Harry, because I know, because I look at his IMDb, and there's at least a page and a half of stuff I've never even heard of or never saw. I know the last thing I saw him in. And even as the drunken barfly in the very first Sharknado,
right?
Yeah, John Hurt was in a Sharknado film.
Yes,
it was a more respectful stunt casting than what that shark than what that film series has done when it comes to stunt casting.
Right. There was a interview I listened to from about a year ago where he basically said, "I haven't done anything serious in 10 years."
Yep.
And that just is heartbreaking.
It is.
Because, you know, and but again, as I said in the beginning, he was very self-aware of the fact that his, you know, his attitude and his naivete and his arrogance early on didn't help.
Right.
You know. But it's not like it kept him from working.
No. And, but, you know, there was, I think, according to IMDb, two things that were completed in post-production and film. I mean, you know, he was working right up until the day he was in the hospital.
And one of the highest profile things that we, you know, after Home Alone that we didn't mention was The Sopranos.
That's right. Yes.
You know, a
not a bad thing in the first season.
Very key role. You know, for what, 5 or 6 episodes of The Sopranos.
So, ladies and gentlemen, this I don't know if it's like this with you, Lou. When an artist passes, I tend to when we kind of did this. You did it with Chili Scenes. I did it with Cutter's Way, of going back and revisiting some of their work. Now, part of it is because of research purposes for this program, but it's a healthy reminder of you don't necessarily, and I tell this to students, you don't necessarily have to be the $20 million a picture thing. So long as you're working, so long as the check's clear, and hopefully, so long as you're doing something that you enjoy. And Hurt is kind of I use the term a walking, talking, what to do and what not to do. You should hopefully be smart enough to figure out the difference.
Right. I will share my one encounter with him.
Yes, please do.
I was at the Humana Festival of New American Plays down in Louisville, and if you care about new work and love being in a vibrant atmosphere, go down there. It's only 2 hours away, and you can see, like, 5 plays in a weekend and all that. So I'm down there on industry weekend, and, you know, there's Paul Bartel falling asleep at a theater, you know, one of the plays. And, you know, other people, you sort of go, hey, who is that? Oh, that's
guy,
who that
yeah.
is. And I run into John Hurd in the lobby.
Man.
And I'm like, I don't do the fan thing.
Yeah, you're pretty reserved on that.
You know, but here's a guy who really had an influence on, you know, my thinking about acting and thinking about writing just by his delivery. I mean, I hear his voice in some of the stuff I try to write.
Did you tell him that?
Well, I basically said, I mentioned Chili Scenes and I mentioned Cutter's Way, and he looked at me, took out his souvenir Louisville Slugger mini baseball bat that he had, pretended to hit me on the head with it, and walked away. That was my encounter with John Hurd.
And that sums it up right there. Lou Harry, thanks you for helping out in the John Hurd retrospect.
A pleasure.
Yes, friends, your pledge dollars at work, where we discuss long form discussion of actor John Hurd, as well as talking with my buddy Ben Ayers about Timepiece Theater Company. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Yes, now it's time, friends, to grab a pencil. Let's start going through what we've been watching in the last week. Now, I was able to watch a new film that's available streaming, and sometimes if you hit me up on social media, it just happens. And this is the case with an English thriller called The Droving. It's set in a lovely coastal town. I believe it's Penrith, Cumbria, is where they filmed it. Pardon my English if I said it wrong, but it's a story of a soldier who returns to his hometown, searching for his sister's killer a year after the fact. And there's also throughout the film, there's talk of this this big festival that happens in this small little village, and that becomes a part of it near the end. As I was watching it, imagine the original Get Carter mixed with the original Wicker Man. We do not discuss the remakes of either one of those, even if you have cocktails while watching the Nick Cage Wicker Man, which, you know, that you're on your own there. But You have the beautiful setting, you have a very determined lead performance, and it's not as bloody as it sounds, and it's not as scary as it sounds, but there is a, kind of like the films of the last couple of years, like Hereditary, Midsommar, there is a feeling of dread throughout, even though you are pulling for this guy to find out who the killer of his sister is. It's only 80 minutes, but it I don't think it needs to be any longer. It doesn't waste time, and it packs a pretty good punch. So I was, and yes, the climax of the film is the title of the film, and you'll just have to see why. But there's some fairly unnerving imagery in this, as far as you have humans wearing animal masks, which is part of this of the droving. But if you like moody dread and you like a little bit of butt kicking, as I mentioned, thus the comparisons to Get Carter and The Wicker Man, The Droving is for you. So go check that out. That is available on streaming. I believe it's Rubicon Films who put it out. So good work there. Now, on video this week, well, of course, for older titles, I know the Deer Hunter has gotten a 4K release. Criterion has put out Wildlife, the series of short films done by Martin Scorsese in the 60s and 70s, as well as John Cassavetes' Husbands. And I'm hoping to pick that's Ben Gazzara, John Cassavetes, and Peter Falk. And I'm hoping to pick those up fairly soon. But one of the films that came out on video this week is the newest version of The Invisible Man, which I believe was opened in theaters and then just kind of went to streaming after everything went down. This is starring Elizabeth Moss, and it's an interesting new take on the story of The Invisible Man, in this case that in 2020, Moss plays a woman who is escaping an abusive relationship with this gentleman who is a fiber optics wizard and is able to create a suit, which makes him the title of the film. So you have that aspect of it, because the original, let's never forget, the original Invisible Man with Claude Rains, he's a cold-blooded killer, but he's got this scientific skill that he's able to use to make him invisible. The less we talk about Hollow Man, the better. But it's anchored by a really good performance from Elizabeth Moss. I know this is not her first time in the horror genre. She had a really nice supporting turn in Jordan Peele's Us. But the modern aspect of it, in this case of leaving an abusive relationship, PTSD, it does play into the old horror film trope of, you know, is she seeing, everybody thinks she's seeing things, she's making it up, and when she's trying to convince people, no, this is really happening, my boyfriend is invisible doing these things, and of course he's pinning it all on her. I like the film for the most part. It does have one extra twist near the end, and I don't want to give it away. I think if they had, and I understand why they did what they did, I think if they had shortened it, you still would have had a punchy little thriller that's still enjoyable, but they wanted to take it one step further. I understand that. I don't think it necessarily needed it. But if you like Elizabeth Moss, it's a good, really good performance from her. And I don't know if this is going to bring back the Universal Dark. They were trying to do an off a horror sub studio of Universal. Of course, that started with The Mummy and with Tom Cruise, and look how well that turned out. Anyway, it's worth checking out. Also new on video is Capone. This is the film with Tom Hardy playing Al Capone in the last year of his life. This is from the writer and director of the last Fantastic Four reboot. In fact, this is his first film after that debacle, which my daughter, by the way, actually liked, and I liked it a little more than other people. As I was watching this, because we have Capone, who is going to die from complications due to syphilis. He's living in Florida with his wife, played by Linda Cardinelli. You have Kyle MacLachlan showing up as a doctor. You have Matt Dillon as an old protege, Capone was a protege, so his mentor. And he's also being under surveillance by the federal government. At times, the film feels a lot like Death of a Salesman. In fact, I remember writing on social media, does Capone talk about meeting the mayor of Providence? Because things are not what they seem in his world. He's starting to see things, especially a recurring through line of a younger version of himself and a couple characters who may or may not have been there, kind of like Willie Loman's brother Ben, among other things. Hardy's fine. This is a performance he can sink his teeth into, and we like that from Tom Hardy. But it does feel fairly familiar with it, and because I'm a theater geek with the Death of a Salesman references. Also, the image that he sees of himself is a little kid with a balloon. I think balloons can take a rest from the cinema world for a while between this and the two It films. But yeah, they're trying to do a deglamorized version of Al Capone, and you get hit over the head a little bit with symbolism with a capital S. It turns out to be a little subpar, although the Tom Hardy performance is pretty good. So that is what is happening. Those are the new things I got to see this week. I mentioned the stuff that's on Criterion. Of course, you can go to the drive-ins over at the Tibbs Drive-In on Screen 1, The Invisible Man. And if we can see something on a big screen, of course I'm going to push that more than I would seeing it in your living room. Just be careful, be cautious. Now, it being a drive-in situation, that would be a good first step back into the movie-going experience. But anyway, The Invisible Man on one screen. The second feature is The Hunt, which I believe comes out on video next week. Screen 2, The High Note, and second feature, Just Mercy. Screen 3, you have Trolls World Tour and Sonic the Hedgehog. And then on screen 4, The Wretched, as well as Fantasy Island. Going old school over at the Skyline Drive-In in Shelbyville, they're showing the Raiders of the Lost Ark and Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. Good chance to see those on the big screen. You can get virtual tickets from IU Cinema to check out Hilma of Beyond the Visible, Hilma of at Clint, as well as Someone Somewhere. Those are happening online over there. Over at the Can-Can Cinema, now, if you're listening to this on Friday at 8:30 p.m., they're going to be showing Harold and Maude at cancanindie.com/@home cinema. Anyway, you can go to Can-Can Cinema in Brasserie, their Facebook page. They have the information there. But, yeah, Harold and Maude is the first dark comedy I ever got to experience, and it was also the first Betamax tape, that's right, you heard that, the first Betamax tape that my father ever purchased, and the great Hal Ashby dark comedy with Bud Cort and Ruth Gordon. So really, really good stuff there. So there's a couple of new titles that I got to watch recently. Now we go back into last week. I in the past, since all this has gone down, I've been trying to maybe have a couple themes eat on particular evenings if possible. I thought I'd try leaning toward romantic comedies on Fridays, especially with the family there. I'm always trying to do a midnight movie after I get off work here on Saturdays. And sometimes some plans work better than others. Let's just put it that way. But going back to the titles I saw last week, I began because I had it on Blu-ray and I had not seen this in a long, long time. 1992's Andrew Bergman film, Honeymoon in Vegas, with Nicolas Cage, Sarah Jessica Parker, and James Caan. Of course, Cage plays a detective who is skittish about getting married because his mother, on her deathbed, told him not to do so. Nice cameo by Anne Bancroft, and of course he's engaged to Sarah Jessica Parker. Sean Stoner, three words, man. I'm with you. Still looks great. But inside joke there. But Cage and Parker are going to go to Vegas and get married, and they get sucked into a card. He gets sucked into a card game by a local businessman, James Caan, who thinks Parker looks like his dead wife. And as Cage loses an incredible amount of money and gets in the debt, Caan offers the clean the slate and clean the debt by taking out Sarah Jessica Parker for the weekend, and thus the love triangle sorta begins. This is around the same time that Indecent Exposure came out. So using your fiance or your wife as property was a subgenre for a blip of a moment. It's not a bad film if you can get past the premise. Cage, this is early Wacky Cage, where we expect these ups and downs with his eccentric characters. Parker does a fine job and looks great. I'm a pig, sorry. And Khan has a nice combination of vulnerability in a couple moments, and then he's still the screen persona of tough guy James Khan. You got the flying Elvises. You got Pat Morita as a cab driver. There's one moment I completely forget about. It's the climax of the film that involves the flying Elvises. Yes, a group of skydivers all dressed as 70s-era Elvis. It's never 50s-era Elvis, you know? Not a big a punchline, I guess. But there's a moment when the guys are falling, including Cage's character, because it's kind of waka waka. When you hear Don Pardo's voice, everybody is outside the streets of Las Vegas watching these guys land. And somehow Don Pardo, as the announcer, got Nicolas Cage's character's name as he was diving into the city streets. Somebody must have called ahead, I guess. So anyway, it's not bad. Andrew Bergman's best film is still The In-Laws, so there is that. And by the way, The In-Laws is available on Criterion. Then I revisited Hell or High Water from 2016. Of course, the great modern Western with Chris Pine and Ben Foster as two brothers who rob a series of banks to pay off some debts, and they're in pursuit by the Texas Rangers, including a soon-to-be-retired Jeff Bridges and Gil Birmingham, who plays his partner. Great camaraderie between both pairs of actors, and really, really good modern-day Western. Still holds up, of course. It earned a Best Picture nomination, and rightly so. You go for the action, but you stay for the four performances. Dipping into the Ingmar Bergman box that I have, I'm about two-thirds of the way through the collection. I'm at disc 20, and I had never seen this before, so no time like the present. But in 1975, Ingmar Bergman filmed a performance of The Magic Flute, of Mozart's The Magic Flute. Now, it's not a National Theater Live performance. He is still shot as a film. I'm sure my IFJA fellow critics will love diving into this debate because they've done that before. But it's a filmed performance, and it's done on a stage. And there's some soundstage moments, but it reminded me as far as the look to Laurence Olivier's film version of Richard III. And Henry V, where you see it's on a stage as opposed to being shot on a location. There's a couple fun moments of actors backstage before they make their entrance. The beginning of the film, you get the overture and you get a montage of close-ups. And of course, with theater, there are no close-ups. You can do that in film, but close-ups of members of the audience watching, getting ready to watch the film, the performance, I should say. And it's the United Colors of Benetton, old, young, black, white, other colors, and especially a young girl whose image, whose reaction shot is brought back throughout the film, and it was a cool take on the audience reaction. I think when you have concert films, some of them you get audience reaction, and some, in the case of, I know, one of the Neil Young concert films where you got no audience reaction. It's all about the performance happening on stage. But I had never seen The Magic Flute. I don't think I've ever heard it from start to finish, and now I have. Now, to the credit of the film, the opera is apparently over 3 hours long. This film comes in at 218, but apparently listening to the special features, very little music was cut for this film. So, fun opera of course, guy with a magic flute and a prince who is set to rescue a princess from the evil clutches of, you know, an evil guy. So, anyway, yes, another example of you can see an Ingmar Bergman film that doesn't involve playing chess with death and or something like Persona, a good stepping stone into the films of Ingmar Bergman, because he also did a lot of plays as a director. More of which I would love to see. On Monday, we had dinner at our house as a family, as the Soci Trios, I like to call us. And my daughter, I believe, had been listening to the soundtrack to the musical version of this story, and we decided to go and visit the original film version, because I had a physical copy of it, hashtag physical copies, but we watched the film version of The Band's Visit, a lovely, lovely film. If you remember from 2007, it's a story of eight Egyptian musicians who are a police orchestra that wind up doing a gig in a small town in Israel. And believe it or not, they made this into a musical. And it's I love the fact that this was made into a musical. I know Tony Shalhoub was in the original cast recording as the head of the orchestra, the conductor. But the fact that it was not Legally Blonde or Footloose or a million other musicals that have been made off of big blockbuster hit movies. So kudos, I guess, to that. If you're going to make a musical out of a stage musical out of a film, doing it as an art house one is pretty cool. I've forgotten how charming this was, where the band shows up early, they have no place to stay, and the locals, including the gorgeous cafe owner, who takes the gentleman in to stay for the night. And it's this kind of, it's also a reminder that cringe humor is not for the U.S. or the U.K. anymore. It can happen in Israel as well. No real serious political message. It's these guys doing this show, and there's a little fish out of water, and there's a little, it also has the kind of local hero, Waking Ned Divine, piece, a cinematic piece of just hanging out in this particular town for a period of time. And, it's subtle, and it's really, really nice to watch. So I was glad we got to revisit that. Going through stuff that I'd watched recently and as well, and maybe because my daughter's getting older and I had it on Blu-ray and I hadn't watched it yet and I needed something to cleanse my palate after a rough day. Not Monday, that was Tuesday. But Monday was fine. But I revisited 2005's March of the Penguins. You've got great landscape footage, you got Morgan Freeman voiceover, and you have penguins. So a little Penguin Peril, but other than that, I remember this was a film I tried taking Lynn and Emma to. Emma was 4 at the time. She became fussy and wound up, I think it was, not feeling well. And Lynn, my lovely wife, much to her credit, took one for the team and hung out in the lobby with her while I got to review the film for radio and stuff I did way back when. But I think that's part of the reason why we have these nature films. It's a good stepping stone for kids, because you have beautiful landscapes and animals to watch, and voiceover by usually a name actor. Sometimes it's the voiceover work is silly, sometimes it's not, and is not in the case of Morgan Freeman. Going back to the Ingmar Bergman box set, a film I had not seen before from 1984 called After the Rehearsal. It's basically a three-person show. Erland Josephson, who's one of the regular players, is the director who falls asleep at his desk after a play rehearsal, which happens in the afternoon. And one of his actresses, the daughter of his friend, shows up, played by a young, unknown then, Lena Olin, at least unknown in the States at this time. And the two of them have quite a bit of banter together. I tend to wince a little bit at two people shows, only because my experiences with them has been shows like Edward Albee's Zoo Story or Venus in Fur, which I wasn't crazy about, or the majority of the film Tape. A third character does come in, an aging actress who does the play as a favor to the director, even though there's only a couple lines. But it's a decent enough three-person talkie play film. It's only 73 minutes, which is thankful. I think I would have gotten headaches if it lasted longer than this, and I'm looking at you, Zoo Story. But it is an emotional roller coaster with the three characters. You wonder, and it gets down, you can figure it out early on when you have an older 40-something gentleman with a 20-something actress. So no real surprises, good performances nonetheless. And anyway, so that's what I've watched this week. Let's go to online, to my email, to Facebook and Twitter, and let's find out what you watch. And we start with my buddy Eric, who always emails these are pretty thorough. Had first time viewing for him the excellent 2018 drama Private Life. This is from Tamara Jenkins, who gave us The Savages. of as he calls it, a showcase for Catherine Hahn and Paul Giamatti as a couple trying to get pregnant. Molly Shannon is in this as well as John Carroll Lynch. I enjoyed it as well. He also liked it. He refers to his next choice, justifiably obscure, 1961's The Deadly Companions. And this is the first feature film of Sam Peckinpah with Brian Keith, Maureen O'Hara, Steve Cochran. Chill Wills is in this. It's funny because I'd mentioned Peckinpah last week on social media after watching Hell or High Water. I've not been a fan of the remakes of the films of Sam Peckinpah, and I don't need most remakes to begin with. But if there's one thing you're going to remake of Peckinpah, you could remake Peckinpah's second film, Ride the High Country, with Jeff Bridges and Kris Kristofferson. All right, going back. A rewatch, 1965's The Hill, which he dubbed as Near Great. This is one of the collaborations between, I believe this was the first collaboration, between director Sidney Lumet and Sean Connery, set in a British Army prison in North Africa during World War II. Connery is one of the prisoners, and one of the things that they are forced to do is marching back and forth over a hill that is made in the center of camp. Really good performances from Connery, as well as Harry Andrews, Ozzie Davis, Sir Michael Redgrave. There were five films that Connery and Lumet made together. This, The Anderson Tapes, The Offense, Murder on the Orient Express, and Family Business. All of those are worth checking out. Family Business, probably the weakest of the bunch, but if you're a longtime listener to this show, I love cinematic gene pools. It's three generations of burglars. Matthew Broderick is the youngest. His father is played by Dustin Hoffman. His grandfather is Sean Connery. There you go. And then a rewatch for Eric of 1926's The General, the Buster Keaton film. Great film, he says. So thank you, Eric, for that. Going back to there's a fun bit where I asked for your film choices, the films that you watch on Thursdays. And it's been fun for people who send it to me early. They feel bad for sending it to me early. They know I asked for it on Thursdays. So anyway, it's been fun to have that. There's also the part where I get to the last comment and people are still posting after the fact. So I remember specifically last week, my buddy Eric Bryant, he had the last comment where he said, "I tried for the fifth time to rewatch Kentucky Fried Movie. Last saw it when it came out," and he just wrote, "just, period, couldn't, period, do, period, it, period." After I recorded the show, I drove home and I called Eric up because I was curious to see how far he got. And he told me 10 minutes. And then we got into a little conversation. Some comedies age better than others. This is, of course, one of the Zucker Brothers films. It's directed by John Landis, but it was a Zucker film before Airplane and Top Secret. And I told him early at the beginning of this pandemic, on a Friday night, I called an audible. The Soci Trio did not have a very fun Friday, and we thought we'll have dinner. And I showed my daughter Airplane, and Emma thought it was funny, but also thought it should have been half as long as the film's length. So there you go. Anyway, thank you, Eric. You're a very good sport. All right, going back to the list. But so these are people that posted from last week's post. But my buddy and fellow critic Bob Bloom said he watched Vast of Night, followed by Check It Out, Soci. So now I'm being told to watch things. Sam Watermeyer, who's also been on the show, says The D-Train. And in terms of new stuff, The Trip to Greece, which we reviewed on last week's show. Robert Muggy, who's been a guest on the show and a fine, fine filmmaker in his own right. Fritz Lang's Dr. Mabuse, The Gambler, The Testament of Dr. Mabuse, and Destiny. Vincent Sherman's Affair in Trinidad with Rita Hayworth and Glenn Ford. Raoul Walsh's Strawberry Blonde with James Cagney, Olivia de Havilland, and Rita Hayworth. I'm going to butcher that. The Cranes Are Flying and Europa Europa. Combine the Criterion Channel with the pandemic, and that's what you get. I get it, Robert. Excellent choices there. Linda writes, The Lighthouse, Harriet, and Bloodshot. Cassandra writes, just watched Emperor with Tommy Lee Jones and Matthew Fox. Well done. Quenin out in California says, watching Double Indemnity for the first time. That's cool. The fact that you're able to see a great old film like that for the first time. So you make chicken salad out of the current situation, out of chicken stuff. Ashley writes, I'm watching Elizabeth tonight. Earlier this week, I watched Dog Day Afternoon. Bob writes, watched Manhattan, which has a great message for our time. Quote, 6 months isn't so long and everybody gets corrupted. You've got to have a little faith in people. See, that's for you Woody Allen fans out there. But yeah, thank you, Bob. Marjorie writes, we watched Casablanca again. Never gets old. Mary writes, Interstellar. Eric, who we talked about earlier, The African Queen, also Contagion. Ray writes, The Duchess, The English Game, Dr. Thorne, Crooked House, and Belgravia. Thank you, Ray. Continuing on, heading over to Twitter for a moment, Emily writes, The Scar of Shame, Losing Ground, Showgirls, oof, Before Sunset, Before Midnight, and Then We Danced, Rust and Bone, Shane, and Safe from 1995. Thank you, Emily. Surely not me at Fish Called. Just watched Mia Hansen's Loves Things to Come yesterday. And I think that's it. Yeah, that's all of those on there. Moving to yesterday's response on Facebook, Manny writes, I did watch Heartburn recently. Meryl Streep, Stocker Channing, and Catherine O'Hara in the same movie. And I respond, of course, on top of that, you have Jack Nicholson, Yakov Smirnoff, and that Kevin guy. So Megan writes, chiming in, love that movie. Sam writes, I rewatched No Country for Old Men. I forgot how scary that movie is. Scariest hotel sequences since Psycho. Nice. Eric writes, Rocket Man. Chloe writes, Honey Boy, the Young Vic production of The Streetcar Named Desire, and Uncut Gems. Megan writes, Chitty Chitty Bang Bang and Contagion. Back to back, Megan? Really? I don't know, maybe. nice stuff there. As I was saying earlier when folks post early, my friend Lee chimed in and said, I know it's the wrong day, but Uncut Gems, intense the whole time. Awesome to see Sandler exercise his drama chops. It's never too late or too early, Lee, but I appreciate the note. Of course, my capsule review of Uncut Gems is film noir on Red Bull. And yes, it's nice to see Adam Sandler actually acting. Joe writes, don't tell anyone, but I might write about one of these. I won't tell them which one you write. We Summon the Darkness, Come to Daddy, Squeegee, Curtains. I also own Curtains on Blu-ray, Joe, so there you go. Killer Workout, Hellhole, The Art of Self-Defense, and Abigail Haunting. Good luck on writing about one of those, Joe. Benjamin writes, Easter Parade, Top Hat, Elysium, Beast of No Nation, and Uncut Gems. Gary writes, Captain America, the 1990 version starring J.D. Salinger's grandson. Avengers Endgame, Captain America, the Winter Soldier. I was in a Marvel mood. Yes, you were. Jamie writes, Emma, the 2020 version. It was utterly delightful and very well done. Carrie writes, Dave. Randy writes the remake of Midway with Woody Harrelson, among others. Jeff writes Baby Driver. David writes The Death of Stalin, which is, and two people chimed in, great movie, so good. I agree, David. That made my top 10 when it came out that year. More people need to see The Death of Stalin. Duke writes Ready or Not and said it was fun. Matt writes The Blues Brothers, Their Finest, and every Pirates of the Caribbean. Michelle writes, Hunt for the Wilder People. More people need to see that as well. Steven writes, The Red Turtle. Gregory writes, The Longest Day. Everin writes, Showed my mom Train to Busan a few nights ago. Bill writes, oh dear. How about old favorites that were like new to us because it had been like 40 years plus? That's kind of what I'm saying. Introduced my lady to Rooster Cogburn, which she had never seen. And we revisited the film version of MASH, which we both largely had forgotten. That is all. Michelle writes, I watched Rocket Man, Bohemian Rhapsody, and A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood last weekend. Interesting to look at how filmmakers portray the lives of three cultural icons from the same era. Jeff writes Nocturnal Animals and responds, whoa. Yeah, I know, Jeff. Rick writes Hot Wax Zombies on Wheels. Not even kidding. Damn this pandemic. Hang in there, Rick. Jared writes Harry Potter 5, The Pianist. This was the first movie that had my boys visibly shaken. It was an awesome family moment. That film will do it, Jared. Way to go. Lou writes, Lou Harry, The Encounter, the Vic Street production of Streetcar Named Desire, The National's Barbershop Chronicles, On the Town, and The Band's Visit. I think I should also thank Lou Harry for bringing up The Band's Visit and motivating me to show that to my family. So thank you, Lou. And, of course, thanks for the chat we had earlier in 2017 that I replayed on this show. David writes, I've been running through the Nightmare on Elm Street series this week. I have no idea why I put myself through this. We all go through that, David. Hang in there. Rachel writes, The Bumblebee Flies Anyway and The House on Haunted Hill. Eric writes, rewatch The African Queen and watch Contagion because I'm just not tortured enough. Eric, you're properly tortured. Just kidding. Mark writes, The Train, a 1965 war flick with Burt Lancaster and Joan Moreau. And that's a John Frankenheimer film, Mark. And I always remember, I believe it's a single shot. It's a great piece of stunt work by Burt Lancaster, who's going down climbs up a ladder, runs across some tracks, goes down a ladder, and jumps onto a moving train, all done in one single take. Look it up, folks. It's really cool. Jill writes, oh, Lord, I literally watch Any Which Way But Loose this week. It happens. Lori writes, Rosemary's Baby and Harold and Maude. Sometimes it's in the timing. Cassandra writes, Macbeth, contemporary-ish Patrick Stewart version. And there's nothing wrong with saying, Macbeth, you're on a podcast. Nothing wrong with that. Gregory writes, Where Eagles Dare. Beverly writes, Melancholia. Kelsey writes, Heartland Films have been listing some incredible films. This week I watched Resistance, the prep for an upcoming program. I made my boyfriend watch A Serious Man because he had never seen it. When the film ended, he looked pretty frustrated. We also watched Charade last week. Way to go, Kelsey. And I love A Serious Man. It's a fine Coen Brothers film. Amy writes, Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban, Twins, Dick Tracy, and started Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. Not a movie I know, but it's new on the list. The Socies also enjoyed Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. Nick writes, Iron Angels, Lady Terminator, The Fifth Cord, Possession, and Battlefield Earth. Oh, he's saying it's Possession by Zulaki, not Neil LaBute. Well done, Nick. JJ writes, Solo, The Empire Strikes Back, The Lovebirds, The Wailing, the Korean horror film, Uncut Gems, finally, The Wrong Missy, The Warwicker Trilogy 1, page 8. Julia writes, I rewatched Their Finest this week. I love that movie and feels it deserves more exposure. I own it on Blu-ray, so way to go, Julia. Brian writes, I watched Blade Runner Final Cut and I have a lot of questions. Stephanie writes, The Fighting Temptations. Tony writes, Reservoir Dogs and Camille. Henry writes, the Imitation Game. Mark writes, Snowpiercer. Kathy writes, watched Vanilla Sky last night. It is still messing with my head. I understand. I know. I remember, I think I was the only one around town who didn't like Vanilla Sky, and I said it on Fox 59 AM and caught serious grief from other people. Come at me. JC writes, Ip Man, which I think I have that, and I need to see if I need, well, I can't remember if it's one or two. I have to check that out. Daniel writes, Never Wave at a Whack, The Picture of Dorian Gray, the one with John Gielgud, Mystify, Strangers on a Train, Hound of the Baskervilles, the one with Basil Rathbone, the TV movie biopic Mae West, starring Anne Gillian. I remember that. Black Magic with Orson Welles, The Invisible Man, the most recent one, Blackbeard the Pirate, and The Owl and the Pussycat. Elaine writes, Hancock. Britt writes, Jurassic World, Mrs. Polifax, Spy, JFK, MASH, Stop at Nothing, The Lance Armstrong Story, Titanic, Drillbit Taylor, Monsters, Inc., and Mulan. Diana writes, A Most Wanted Man, Season 1 of Lost, and The Invitation. Tom writes, great documentary on Hulu, Batman and Bill, about how the creator of Batman, Bob Crane, obstructed the revelation that Batman had a significant co-creator named Bill Finger. The journey to get Finger his creative recognition with Warner Brothers is a detective story worthy of The Dark Knight. A daughter discovers the lost legacy of her father and grandfather. A great documentary. Janet writes, I finally watched Joker, as well as Indecent Proposal, 8 Men Out, Inside Daisy Clover, 7, and Contagion. Chad writes, did you catch Demolition Man on Hulu? It was oddly prophetic to watch. Lori writes, Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice. And finally, Linda chimes in, Zip, just rewatching The White Princess on Stars, finished The White Queen, great casting. And there you go, folks. So hopefully you're watching, as I say this every week, new movies and or new movies that are, or at least movies that are new to you. So I understand the attraction of revisiting stuff that we know we like, but we got time. Hopefully you take a chance on one you have not experienced, whether it's new or old. I want to end this week's show with Dead People We Like, because we never have time for Dead People We Don't Like. Writer and activist Larry Kramer died on May 27th at the age of 84. Best known for his plays like Sissy's Scrapbook, A Minor Dark Age, The Normal Heart, Just Say No, a play about a farce, The Furniture of Home, and The Destiny of Me, among others. But besides that, a huge LGBTQ activist. But in Hollywood, his right out the gate in 1968 was credited with doing additional dialogue for Here We Go Around the Mulberry Bush. And then in 1969, received an Academy Award nomination for his adaptation of D.H. Lawrence's Women in Love. Yes, the Ken Russell film, the film that got Glenda Jackson a Best Actress Award. And for a what looks like a masterpiece theater costume drama, also has quite a bit of nudity, sex scenes, and a famous naked wrestling scene between Alan Bates and Oliver Reed. You're welcome. His follow-up, his cinematic follow-up, would be doing the screenplay for the much brutalized musical, the musical version of Lost Horizon, with Liev Ullmann, Peter Finch, John Gielgud, Olivia Hussey. Not a good film. Not a good film. Even if Burt Bacharach and his partner did the music, oh boy. Then also did the screenplay for his play, The Normal Heart, and that's in 2014. There was a TV movie of Larry Kramer, which plays the Destiny of Me and The Normal Heart, and of course the 2015 credit for Destiny of Me. So salute Larry Kramer. Check out his plays. And yeah, if you get a chance, revisit Women in Love. And then we go to, as Tracy Forner referred to, Fringe That Guy. Character actor Anthony James passed away this week. And normally playing kind of sleazy, scary-looking characters. But we'll go through some of the titles in a second. I think the cool piece of trivia with Anthony James is that his first film credit and his last film credit, both Best Picture winners. He played Ralph in 1967's In the Heat of the Night, and then his final film in 1992 played Skinny Dubois in Clint Eastwood's Unforgiven. He, I believe, has the great line when he finds out that the prostitutes have hired a gunman, a gunman to go and avenge one of the ladies who was cut up, $1,000, but they don't have the money. And Skinny says, "What are you going to do? F him 1,000 times." I clean that up, obviously. Anyway, played Cousin Leroy in Sam Whiskey, appeared several episodes of Gunsmoke and The Big Valley, was in Tick, 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 the Southern drama with Frederick March and Jim Brown. A sub thing that he's sort of known for, and it's also utilized in the Sally Lloyd Closet documentary, but he plays one of the hitchhikers in 1971's Vanishing Point. I was also in the Culpeper Cattle Company, played in Clint Eastwood's High Plains Drifter, was in The Teacher from 1974, Hearts of the West, was the chauffeur, was the creepy-looking chauffeur in Burnt Offerings, played Sickle in Return to Witch Mountain, Texas Detour, The Fifth Floor, did a lot of TV, was in Buck Rogers and Man from Atlantis. Yes, he was in an episode of Enos. Also played in Soggy Mountain Bottom USA, Wacko, Blue Thunder, was in the TV series of V, World Gone Wild, Mortuary Academy, 1989's Beauty and the Beast. He did a lot. I'm not just doing every single credit that that Anthony did, but yeah, piercing eyes, kind of sunken cheeks, swollen, sunken chin, very, very intimidating looking guy. But so kudos to Anthony James. Thanks for all of your work and imagery that is pierced in the hearts of cult movie fans everywhere. So with that in mind, friends, here's some words to live by.
Silent breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Go see a good movie. You deserve it. There's plenty out there. Like I said, try something new and as well as films that you you rely on in these troubled times. Stay healthy, stay safe, stay sane, and we'll do this again next week. I want to end this week's show with a little bit, because we mentioned John Hurt more than one occasion, and the fact that Ben saw cat people. Yes, it was also used well in Inglourious Basterds and to a certain degree in Atomic Blonde, but from the film Cat People, here's David Bowie with Cat People. Thanks for listening. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan.
And I've been putting out fire with gasoline.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
Okay. We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!